Welcome to my podcast, Therese Makes History. My name is Therese Sweeney. I've been facilitating, writing and producing histories for communities, regions, industry, families for 30 years. This project is called the Dairy Lane Project. This episode is part supported by Turf Co., owned by Gavin Rogers, who is located off the highway in Jasper's Brush. They're the biggest agricultural employer in the region and have been operating for 40 years. Gavin is helping me realise the production, and I'm grateful. Episode 3, Boxall's Lane. I've undertaken a series of recordings with Richard Boxall recently. Boxall's Lane in Maroo Meadow, named after his early dairying farming family. I'm going to talk about Richard's heritage and position where his family were farming, because there are many Boxalls in the region and beyond. Richard's a descendant of emigrant Thomas Boxhill, who came on the boat Neptune from Sussex, England, in 1839 with his wife Mary. They had 10 children, one of which was Richard, who was 10 years old. Thomas Boxhill later died in Gerringong in 1875. 10-year-old Richard is the great-grandfather to our Richard Boxhill. Great-grandfather Richard settled on Kangaroo Mountain after marrying Catherine Nelson in 1863. They had 10 children. Unfortunately, Richard died young at age 49 in 1878. Catherine, his wife, lived till 1909 up at Bellawonga, raising those 10 children. Think about her life. Slab hut, bush, no water at hand, all power, isolation, wind, heat, growing food, cooking, wood chopping, and additionally, milking a small herd, making cream to deliver by foot or slide down the treacherous mountain to a creamery depot. Richard's brother, great-uncle John Boxall, around the mid-19th century, owned 160 acres in Broughton Vale and was president of the reorganised Broughton Creek Show Society in 1888 and 1890. He died in Bury in 1895. One of 10 siblings, grandfather Richard Boxall, was born in 1865 on Kangaroo Mountain. The brothers up on the mountain had quite a reputation, mixing rum with boxing. Grandfather Richard lived at Forest Lodge, Maroo, up till 1892 with his wife, Minnie Anna Graham. They had married at Bellawonga in 1888. Minnie was born in 1866 at Maroo. She was the daughter of William Graham and Isabella Emery, who resided at Woodside, Maroo, on 90 acres from 1865, the year they married. They eventually accumulated a further 76 acres. William only lived till age 40. Richard and Minnie moved to Myrtlebank, Maroo, from 1892 on 220 acres, hand milking 8 cows. A terrible tragedy took Minnie early. She died in 1920. They had 8 children. Richard's 2 siblings, Maud and Clyde, also married a Graham in Maroo. I'm going to read to you passages of a publication where the Boxall brothers are referenced. The book is The History of Illawarra and Its Pioneers, published originally in 1922. Written by Frank McGaffrey. The original copy sits in Cornell University Library in New York. It's readily available as a download, and I strongly recommend the book, especially for those interested in breeding. I'm quoting, "At Myrtlebank, the Boxall family have been long and favourably known as dairy farmers and dairy cattle breeders, first at Omega, then Kiama, and afterwards at Bury in the Illawarra district, covering easily a period of 70 years. The writer, Frank, saw John Bury's dairy cows in the Bury district. They were of the Longhorn Durham type, dairy cows of great merit. Once the low-bred bull, a mudgy-bred shorthorn, went into the Boxall herd, the old Longhorn Durham type gradually disappeared. The Boxall brothers Myrtlebank stud of dairy cattle at Maru Meadow was established in 1893. The Boxall brothers, all through, have looked ahead and used their eyes before buying a sire. They are moving forward. End of quotes. Two of those dairy cows from the property later feature in the publication from Myrtlebank. Two cows, Pigeon of Myrtlebank and the bull Charmer's War Bond, which you can view later, I'll let you know where. William Victor, known as Bill and Jock, and Clyde Nelson Boxall stayed on Myrtlebank when their father could no longer run the farm. Their sister Kate stayed too, cooking and assisting. Their father Richard later died in 1936. Richard had eight children with Minnie Anna. One of those happens to be the current Richard Boxall's father, Lindsay Charlton Boxall. He was born in 1909 at Myrtlebank. He married Catherine Ann Allen, also known as Kitty. They married in 1945. Today I'm presenting the interview with Richard Boxall. I call him Richard III, who was born at Myrtlebank and later moved to Woodside up the road at age one. Richard and his wife Laurie reside on a small portion of the Woodside property on Graham's Road, and I present to you his story. So what year were you born, Richard, and what is your full name?
1954 I was born, Richard Lindsay Boxall, born at Myrtlebank, which was the old original my grandfather's farm.
And how big was that farm, and where was that located from here?
East direction, just straight down over the hill from where we are now. It would have been a big farm. It would have been 220 acres, maybe more, I don't know. But I'm thinking because there was the people that own it now, or did own it, they cut off two blocks. And the only way you could do that with a council regulation to get a building permit was 100 acre lots. It's 200 acres plus, yeah.
So you were born there.
Yes.
Who are your siblings?
I had older sister, Marie. She was born 1946. And then my brother, Alan, William, he was born in 1948.
So you were the youngest?
Yeah.
Who owned Myrtlebank?
Richard, my grandfather, Richard Boxall.
What has been told to you about your grandfather, Richard? Because there's the photograph where he's got his Salvation Army uniform on, I noticed.
Yeah, I believe from what I was told, he and his brothers had I presume farmed or up on what they call the Berry Mountain. They were pretty wild lads, and they liked to scrap, as in a boxing, and they liked their rum. But I'm not sure what stage. A cousin of mine, she was visiting, she told me that the story about him being pretty rough. But he took up a vision at some stage, and that's when he joined the Salvation Army and stopped drinking, smoking, dedicated the rest of his life with Minnie Anna, his wife, in the Salvation Army.
What was his stature? Do you know how big he was
physically? Yeah, he's a big man, 6'6", solid, yeah.
So you didn't get his genes?
No, I didn't. My dad didn't. My dad got it from, as they call the Granny Graham, Isabella. She was about 4'6".
So he was 6'6", Scottish Protestant?
Yeah, Scottish, English, Cornwall.
Their water supply, where was that sourced?
Yeah, it started up in the spring up in the top of the mountain in Woodside. I believe it was piped, gall pipe was put in after the war to feed water down to the dairy, but prior to that, it would have been just water holes. There was wells where the house is now, the original house. Dad said over the house going west, there was a well where his grandmother used to draw water from for the house.
Which is probably the main source for them to carry the water.
Yes, yeah, it was carried, yeah.
When you talk about pipes coming down with the dairy, when your dad was working the dairy. What sort of pipes? What were they made of?
It was inch galvanised pipe, which withstood the time for rusting, and eventually it corroded inside. It was there until probably 1991, 92, we replaced it with polythene.
That would have been a bit of an effort to install that piping.
Yeah, it took a lot. The people that had brought Mum and Dad part of the farm back in 1977.
What was their name?
Ganderton's, Bob and Mary Ganderton. He was a butcher from Wollongong. So they had beef cattle on here. They'd come down probably weekends and that sort of thing.
But so did your parents subdivide the land?
They sold it off in one chunk, which was 100, and Dad and them kept about 25 acres, part of where we are at the moment, Laurie and I.
And how much would have been sold?
Probably 140 acres. It's been sold probably twice since then. Yeah.
When you're talking about them sharing food with the killing of a beast, who would they be? What were the neighbours then? Do you recall any of the names?
So Mum, main one, would have been up on Brown's Mountain, so you would have had, obviously, the Brown family. Forsyths were the other family up there.
Do you recall how your mother washed?
Here in the laundry, they had a copper boiler in the corner. She did have a washing machine with the wringer up the top.
Okay, so you had the dairy. What type of dairy was it?
The one up here where we are was a six-stand, six-bale. So six cows at a time, two, two, two. A lot of them, when you look at them, they were only four stand.
So how would you store feed?
There was, you couldn't make hay up here, it was too steep. There was no frost. The mainstay was Kaikuya, Paspalum. So it was all just natural grass. Your subterranean clover, which was a native of. Later on in during the farming, Dad and them, they would introduce some ryegrass for the winter. And then later, probably in his last 6 years of dairying, they started to grow corn, paddocks of corn, and they'd hammer mill that through the winter for winter feed for the cows up to feed them up in the dairy as they were being milked.
They didn't store it?
No, it was picked by hand, stored in bags, and then it was put through a hammer mill and back into bags, and then it was taken up to the dairy and dished out, ladled out into the feed bins while the cows were being milked.
Where was the corn stored in the bags?
It was an old cream separating room. They had a cream dairy just down below where we live at the moment. Beside that, there was a hand mixed. There's still a bit of the concrete remaining there. That was a separating room. So later on then, when we farmed up here, my dad and my brother who worked on the farm, they enclosed it with posts cut from trees over the back with corrugated iron, and that was where the hammer mill was. The hammer mill was driven by the PTO of my brother's tractor.
How do they heat the water? And explain the system for the milk to pass from the cow. Was it hand-milked?
No, they had the vacuum machines, so the teat cups. The heater, as a kid, was pretty modern. It was an electric heater. Later on, it wore out, and they replaced it with a copper chip heater. Milking machines, you had two pipes running through the full length of the dairy. One was your air vacuum compressor, and the other one was the big milk line that went through to the vat. The pressure, from memory, worked on about 15 pounds per square inch. Had a gauge there, which had to be a safety gauge. Yeah, and there was a compressor, milk compressor, which drove the air, the suction, that worked the teat cups. So you had your air line, your milk lines coming down into the teat cup.
The cups had to be pretty clean, didn't they? Because you didn't want to get bacteria the teats had to be...
Yeah, of a morning, the first thing, and the afternoon, you run sterilised water through the teat cups. Then at the end of the dairy, they was the same thing. There was they were flushed through to the vat. Then they were hot water, sterilised, flushed again. Then the main milk line, You had, it was like a coarse brush, yeah, probably about 6-8 inches long, and that was fed through, it was a trick. You take the plug out of the end of the milk pipe and you'd feed the brush into that. It was on a long string. You'd hold your hand over the milk line until you felt that suction coming, pulling your hand in, and it was a trick. You let go all of a sudden, and it was just like a pull through. It just like went like a rocket straight through to the vat. It pulled the brush. So you do that probably about 3 times to clean out your milk lines. Alpha Larval was the pipeline, the milking lines. Denga G, the vacuum pump.
What were the teats made of?
It's hard to say what sort of rubber. They were very pliable but strong but not harmful.
So durable.
Durable, yeah, if that's the word.
Do you know how long they'd last? Did you have to replace them?
Yeah, they'd perish. You'd hear them sucking air because of the action of them in and out, sort of to create the suction for the teats. I can remember Dad, Sunday was his day where he didn't work, but after breakfast he'd spend a couple of hours up in the dairy and he'd pull all the teat cups to bits, replace the rubbers that were worn, scrub everything inside with a small brush, sterilise them, put them all back together. That was an art. You had a special tool because of the rubber teat cups, the way they fitted over the metal moulding. It was like fitting a tyre to a rim on a car. It was very hard.
Who supplied the dairy mechanisation?
I'm thinking it would have come through the dairy co-op somewhere, but you also had an agent. He was a representative for the Alpha Larval vacuum pump, compressor pump.
And how would the agent appear?
If Dad had a problem, ring him up. Or some cases it was all done around the Bomondory pub. You'd mention it and they'd say, yeah, I'll come up and have a look. So he'd drive up in his car. And
the agent was a local person?
Yeah. Yeah, Col McCoy is the one I remember.
So how many cows were they milking then?
Probably 58 to 60, 62, 65. They'd increase through the winter.
Why would you increase the herd in winter?
Well, with the element, the weather and that cold, wet, miserable weather, the cattle, the milk production, they suffer, yeah. So they don't let down or produce as much milk.
What's the weather like in winter up high, up here?
Windy. Winter time, the southwesterly winds, they were savage. Look, you took it in your stride. You look out now when some of those big wind, those rain squalls and hail hit, you took it in your stride. You're up there milking. So you just looked out and, oh yeah, it's pretty wild, it's cold, I'll put a coat on, walk out, bring some cows in. Winter time, you'd rug up, you'd have singlet, flannelette shirt, overalls, possibly another jumper on that, but by the time you got it working in amongst the cows, the heat coming off them, by the end of the milking and the sun starting to come up, you'd be down to just the short sleeves. Roll your sleeves up.
The milkers were, what type of cows were they at this point in your dad's era? Because was it the same as your grandfather's era?
Yeah. They stuck with the Illawarra Shorthorn. They were deemed to be Dad said they were a tougher breed. They'd handle the elements a bit better than the Holstein and the Jerseys. But mixed in amongst the herd, they would have some Guernsey and a couple of Jerseys just to build up the butterfat content.
So when they initially had a smaller herd for cream and butter, what type of cows were they using then?
They would have had a lot more of the Jersey breed mixed in them. It's hard to say when they were first at Myrtlebank. I don't know. They may have had the Jerseys and Guernseys. And it might have been after that where Dad's two brothers figured in breeding of the Illawarra Shorthorn.
So can you talk a bit more about that? Do you know? Because I noticed sort of around 1912, they look like they've won some shows.
Yeah, that's all I know. They figured up and down the coast, winning a lot of prizes with their breeds.
So what shows were important to the family? Do you know what people attended generally?
Yeah, the local shows, all from Kiama down. Dad's oldest brother, Richard, Uncle Dick, He judged a lot of the fruit at the shows. Friday was the main judging, so that's what Dad's two brothers were, Phil Ora Shorthorn and all the others. It was the main parade day, judging and parade day was Friday. And then you had the local exhibits in the pavilion in Nowra, which was your cakes all the way from the women down, who could grow the biggest corn, highest corn, watermelons, all your vegetables, pumpkins, the whole range. Big exhibits, big.
How would you take the animals to the show?
There were cattle trucks in my era from memory. There was some contractors and that had cattle trucks. Calligan's out here at Jasper's Brush, Les Turner, they were the small ones. Then you had Austin Henry in Nowra. He was one of the bigger contractors. Nelson's from the valley. So they were transported in cattle trucks, yeah.
Can you recall some of your dad's biggest challenges that he had? And events like fire, do you recall? I think you said there was a bad fire in the 60s, and maybe talk about how that was fought and what sort of equipment they had and why it was successful.
Yeah, I think prior to the fires, him and Mum would talk, but he never really let on that he was stressed, but he would have been, because we went through it was about a 3-4 year drought, and it got that bad. It's the first time ever we had to buy, they were S trucks, so trucks of hay picked up from the Berry Railway Station, and that's the only time they had to buy feed here on the farm. So that would have been pretty bad times for them, I reckon. Then at the end of that drought in 1968, October, the bushfires had been burning down in the Morrill Estate Forest west of Kangaroo Valley probably a month before they actually hit here. And the firefighters, they were trying to stop it as they could, but the fire spotting, the winds and the westerly winds were horrific, were beating them. But they only had, well, they would have had a small fire truck, which was limited, but most of it would have been knapsacks, 15-litre knapsacks. There was a hoe specially designed for digging and knocking over a burning stump or raking the leaves, wet hessian bag, green tree limb. It was pretty basic, but they were able to access it. What helped them a lot to get in was, back in the day, the logging industry was really, you know, booming. And those logging people, that was their livelihood in the bush. So those logging tracks were maintained by them all the time, their own expense. That allowed, and plus they had bulldozers. So they, along with the firefighters, they'd be there and they push in containment lines to try and stop the fire.
It came over the mountain.
Yeah, eventually. The embers, about a week before it hit, the embers were coming over in the westerly wind, the leaves. You could still see a spark on them. I can remember my mum, Dad, they blocked up the gutters, downpipes around the house, and my mum, she would fill the gutters with water. And then eventually the westerly wind, it beat them in Kangaroo Valley, and it jumped the top of the Camborra Mountain here above us. And hence, it just spent 3 days in, come down around the bush, out into the paddock, on the farm. So they were 3 days fighting that. It eventually ended up in the bush just around below Mum and our house, Mum and Dad's house. And the only thing that saved Maru, if the westerly wind had kept it going, it would have kept going straight through Maru out Jasper's Brush. But the southerly buster come in and blew it back into itself and helped put it out. I don't know, Dad would have been remembering him. He was about 3 days in bed. He was exhausted.
I think there was a story about Kitty in the fires.
Mum was a pretty reasonable frame woman, but Albert Muller was the captain of the fire brigade down here, Muller's farm. They had a small truck with, I don't know how many gallons, a tank on the back and a little pump. But there was something like 20. But so I was only 14. I probably thought it was pretty good at the time. I had 3 days off high school. But Mum and I did the milking. I'd take the milk down on the tractor. When I'd come back, we'd clean up, load the milk cans up with fresh water and put it on the back of the carryall, the tractor. We'd drive as far as we could, and then she'd get on one side of the can with me, and we'd carry it across the gullies for them to have a drink or replenish the knapsack.
Can I just move to the logging industry? What wood were they logging? What's natural to this area, and what were they logging?
In the early days, and they stopped it not long after I can remember, a lot of it was the cedar. Then it turned to the hardwood, your grey gum, iron bark, box. They were the main timber milling.
Where was the mill?
You had one at Williams's at Berry, the one out at Beach Road. I'm not quite sure who owned that. There was in Bomaderry, where Bomaderry Bowling Club is. That was Hoffman's Mill, run by Tetley's. And then down where do-it-yourself in Bomaderry is now, Mitre 10, that was Reed and Hearn. Yeah, Artie Hearn and Jack Reed.
Can we just go back to Dairy in your grandfather Boxall's time? The water came from what creek?
Tullian Creek. That runs under the highway down here now near Muller's Farm.
So how would they keep the milk cool before it went to the factory?
They would have had to carry it around to the creek up here where the Grahams were. But down Myrtlebank where the Boxalls were, they had a water hole that they kept after a flood. They would get in and work, they'd take out all the big boulders. So down in the creek, in the shade, they'd put the cream cans in there. I'm not sure how often they went in.
But it was cool enough.
Oh, yeah, cold, yeah.
And was there a relative that made some jelly or something?
Yeah, Auntie Kate. I'm not quite sure what order she come in, but she was still left on the farm, and she'd done a lot of the cooking and what have you for her two older brothers, Jock and Clyde. She'd make a jelly and she'd take the jelly down and set in the Coal Creek. The jelly she made, sitting when she went to get it, it had tadpoles set in the middle of the jelly. Yeah. They would have just picked them out and they would have ate the jelly. I mean, somebody now looked at it. Like Dad's oldest brother, he had a dairy farm when he came back from the war. He settled on a dairy farm out of Broughton Vale. Whenever I'd go out there, he had magnificent mandarin, orange, fig. Him and Dad would walk around talking. They'd never pick anything off a tree. It was picked up off the ground. Yeah. Like Mum preserved a lot of peaches and that sort of thing.
Maru had its own run, did it, to collect the milk?
Yes, yeah. It started, the one that I can remember as a kid was Jack Atfield from Bomaderry. The run started at about the silos, Turner's Lane silos, going into Jasper's Brush and continued all the way around through Maru to Bell's Lane. Later on, probably the late 60s, he finished up and Bill Schofield took over until then when bulk milk came in. And obviously then he went out of business.
How many dairies were in the Maru area? And do you want to talk about the run, the pickup run?
Yeah, I can do that. From memory, I can pretty well get through. So starting at where the Silos Winery is now, that was Wiley's Farm. That was on the north side of the highway. On the southern side, and you had to go over the railway line with Davis. You come along then into Turner's Lane, you had Walsh's, which is still there now, run by Frank Walsh, his grandson at the moment. Turner's in that lane. Then you come out of there, along, turn right, which headed north again into Devitt's Lane. The ones I can remember up there is Waters, West Waters, and Radford's. Come back out of there, and straight opposite was Marshall's Lane, which run down over the railway line. So down there you had two brothers, Len and George Marshall, and another chap called Warby. You come out of there, then back onto the highway. So then the first one along there was Martin's on your left. Further down then you had what was originally was called Abernethy's Farm. It was run by Alec and Enid Rutledge. Then you come out of there, further along past the Maroo School to your left was Albert Muller's Farm. Come along then a short hop and you got into Boxall's Lane. So on the corner then of the old post office were the Marshall sisters. Ada run the exchange and the mail. The other two sisters, they run the dairy, and it was only small. I think they had a toucan quota, probably about maybe 30 acres, if that. From there you come along then, which was Barron's Farm, run by his daughter then, Jean and Fred Bennett. Out of there you come along to Elliot's Lane, and hence the farm at the end of that was Arthur Elliot, Arthur and Grace Elliot, which was the old Richard Boxall Myrtle Mean. Come out of there, up on top of the hill, to your right was Estridge's, Ivan Estridge. Along then to the intersection of Boxall and Pestles and Grange Road, you had, the first one was Carey's Farm, but it was farmed then by the ones I remember. I can remember Frank Carey. By then he was living in Bury, but the farm was leased out to Bob and Jean Kellett. Later, after them, was Phil and Margaret Birch. And then later on, Carey's daughter and son-in-law, Graham Hutton, they come back to and took over to run the farm. Further up from that, at the base of the hill, was Frank and Norma Bell. And then at the top of the mountain, E.L. Graham and L.C. Boxall. So then you went back out down Pestles Lane. You had Pestles Farm, and dairying there at the time was Byron's. Opposite them were more Marshalls, Oz and Cora Marshall. Keep going out Pestles Lane back onto the highway. So I'm hopping back then north to, on your left, if you're heading north, was Hearn's Farm, which was run by his son-in-law, daughter and son-in-law, Reg and Lorna Keft. Opposite them, Patrick Muller will be able to tell you, I think that was originally another one of the old Mullers that settled in the area. But the people I can remember there were Macaulays. Come back out of there and head south to the corner of Maroo Road, you had Feeney's, Eric and Rita Feeney. Further down then to Fletcher's Lane, you had Vaughan's, Limry's, and then down over the railway line were Shepherd's. Further down Maroo Road, coming out of Fletcher's, Ernie Henry, they had a farm there, and I think Jack Atfield and them, they picked the milk up from there. Back out onto the highway, had on your left Abernethy's Farm, Jack and Eileen Abernethy. Watts's Farm is where the tanker, milk tankers and that, they use that now as a depot. Pretty sure that was still active. So then you went around in to the Mossvale Road, so you went through there then to Bell's Lane. So you had Bell's Farm, Joe and Florrie. Up further you had Bill and Judy Urquhart. And then at the end of that lane was Clive and Adele Marshall. That's pretty well my memory of the milk run that Jack Atfield and Bill Schofield did.
The reason you have such good memory of the dairy families is because it was a smaller community.
Yeah, and most of them went to the school down here, Maroo Public School. Marie and Alan were that age where they didn't so much, they'd rather do something here, but I'd just jump in the Land Rover with my dad. I was only 5, 6, 7. But he was the president of the PNC. So, for instance, when the Red Cross collection was on, he'd go and do all that. And that's, I think, stuck in my memory, all the places he'd visit to collect. So I think that helped. Those who could give, it was just you knock on the door, I'm collecting. And you respected people. Some of them didn't have the money. That's how we got to know, by driving around. I should mention, with the school, they're all the dairy farms, but you've got, there was other ones living down in Turner's Lane, Miller's. Then near the Maroo School, there was a family there from way back, Duncan's, and they're still there today. So they were non-farming, but they were in the area. But all I know is Keith Duncan, he was a taxi driver. The Millers, I think their dad worked on the council.
So you haven't mentioned Berry much, because you were separate from Berry.
Yeah, there was a different...
And Jasper's Brush.
Yeah, Jasper's Brush, that was another... It was collected by Bert Mitchell, that owned the contract. He had the contract for picking milk up there. So Nowra was small, but we figured more with Nowra than Berry. Even the school at Jasper's Brush, it was a rare occasion. Out of the blue, they'd just have an interactive sport day or something like that. It didn't happen often.
So you didn't really venture out much of your own areas?
No, it was all contained. The Maru Hall down here, that was the entertainment. Probably a lot of people come from Jasper's Brush. Obviously, Jasper's Brush in for the dances and...
But you could get the radio here.
Yeah, we had the radio. There was Biggles, Smokey Dawson. There was a comedy one, Green Bottle. Those sort of things.
There was a sort of get-together in Nowra, though, called Shake Hand Tuesday.
Oh, that was from before I went to school. So what would be my memory? Two-year-old, three-year-old, going into town... Yeah, they called it Shake Hands Day. Everybody knew everybody. 90% of them be farmers. Yeah, the car park then, where Jelly Bean Park is, all down the back where Woolies car park is, that was all bush. Over where Woolworths are now, that was Harrison's bus depot garage, where you walk up through Morrison's Arcade, where Darryl Lee, all that up there was Morrison's butcher, Henry Morrison. Further up the main street, you had Bash's, Ted's Milk Bar, Clemmy Holland's Butcher. Right up the very top, it's a government building now. That was West's Picture Theatre. So there was two picture theatres in town. Further along Berry Street, you had the Roxy. Come back down on the other side, you had the Red Rose Cafe, the Bank. You had the New York Cafe in the middle of the town, near Davies Newsagent.
Was that owned by a Greek person?
Yeah, Theo Dapalopoulos or something. It was a big cafe.
Handshake Tuesday, what was the purpose? You'd go in...
If they owed money at Bash's, like paying off a monthly thing, put in the butcher order. If they needed new shoes, Pat McGuire's, he was the shoe man down there, not far from the New York Cafe. There was a dentist on the corner of Rodway Arcade called Phil Lusk. There was a chemist, the Morrises. Anybody had a problem with their kids or anything, and you couldn't get to the doctor, she was probably better than a doctor, or Mrs. Morris.
Did you go to particular places?
I can remember. I'd go with Dad to start with. Mum must have went her own way. Put the order into Henry Morrison, up to Bash's. It was a real treat. But Ted's Milk Bar, a little narrow place, as in Ted Hewlett, which was later moved down the bottom where Rockman's are, Hewlett's Sports and Record Bar. But he had a machine there then, it was new, was a soft dairy delight, ice cream. We'd go and then probably by then meet back up with Mum. So I'd be handed back over. Dad would go down to the sales, cattle sales, which was down near the entrance to the Stocklands now. Dad had come back up from the sales with a few of the other farmers. They'd probably slip into the Prince of Wales Hotel out in the back garden and have a beer. Then it was in the Land Rover back home for milking time.
Did you dress up?
Yeah, I had a denim type of pair of shorts, grey shorts, braces, little braces, buttons on the fly. My claim to fame is that I've actually done a wee in the main street of Nowra. Mum said, your father taught you how to wee like a man. This day I thought, I've got to go to the toilet. And while Mum was talking, I walked out in over the gutter and undone the fly and I had a wee.
How old were you then?
Probably about 3, 4. Obviously I was there with them, so I wasn't at school.
Who were your friends?
Most of it was at school or picnic days. We just made our own fun up here with my brother. But we were all, the school was pretty small in numbers. So, yeah, we just all knew each other at school.
Tell me about picnic days and how often.
Once a year was a Sunday school picnic. And that was run on the Mullers farm. It was pretty flash. They had a cement cricket wicket there. So that must have dated back to the early days. Vonnie and Albert, they opened up their farm there, and we'd all gather down there, all denominations, hence the Catholic, Protestant. There'd be all novelty race, egg and spoon race, three-legged race, knapsack race, foot race, game of cricket. But the men, their main one was the competition, who could nail a nail into a tree stump, how many blows it would take. They'd have a block there. By the end of the day, you couldn't drive another nail into it. There was that many nails. They'd step up and have a go. And I think Frank Bell down, so it was all in the eye and the power, what they call a four-inch nail. And I think Frank Bell, it was something like four hits. And that nail went straight in without bending, obviously.
How did you meet your wife, and what is your wife's name, and when did you get married?
Laurie Kilner is a maiden name. She worked at the South Coast Register with she wasn't my sister-in-law at the time, but she worked there at the South Coast Register, and there was a cricket presentation night coming up, and just out of the blue something, Diane, she said, Laurie that works with us in at the South Coast Register is not going out with anybody at the moment. And I thought about it. There was three of us, my mate Trevor, Henry and Chris, and they were saying, oh yeah, we'll ask her out. So nothing was done. So I rang her up one day at work, and while she was at work, and said, you want to come out? And the rest is history. So we were engaged in 1975, probably the end of 1972, beginning of 73 we went out, engaged, married in 13th of March 1976.
And where did you live after you were married?
We moved into a set of flats in Bombardieri in Numrock Street. We were there for probably about 3-4 years. By then, we had the block out here. We brought the block off Mum and Dad, the acre and a half, and it was a matter of teeing up a loan and a bank loan where we could start, and we ended up with a building company called A.V. Jennings. So in 1980, we moved up here. Mark was born when we were in Bombardieri in the flats, and then later in 1981, Mark was born on the 5th of April, 1979, and Tanya was born up here in the 14th of March, 1981.
You didn't go into dairying, though, did you?
No.
Why not?
There wasn't enough financially. My brother, Alan, he was paid on the farm for a while. Later on, he was here for a few years. He went out and worked on other farms, employment. But no, there wasn't enough to keep me on the farm. Dad would have liked it. So I ended up, applied for three jobs. I ended up with greenkeeping apprenticeship at Berry Bowling Club. All our growing up, we were in the dairy, done our bit. Even when I started at Berry, I'd be up early, help Dad. By then he was on his own, his cousin had passed away. And then I'd go to Berry Bowling. I had to be at Berry at 7:30. Come home for an afternoon and go up to help them finish up washing up. So it just went on, yeah. We all hooked in.
Did you spend your career as a greenkeeper for years or
I
what?
I did. Not much variety in my life. I was 7 years at Berry Bowling Club and 40 years at Nowra Bowling Club. Took over as head greenkeeper in 1988 at the Nowra Bowling Club and remained there until 2018.
You would have been impacted by some weather events?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, everything revolved. I used to have my think tank at 3 o'clock in the morning, what program was going, what bowls were on. When I get there, if it's raining, this is what we're going to do. If it's not raining, fine. Yeah, it was always a think tank. You never had a moment to...
What about major water events?
Yeah, Berry Bowling Club. My initiation, I started in January at the Berry Bowling Club, 1971. By the end of January, massive floods and the greens flooded three nights in a row. Thursday night was 12 inches of rain. The Friday night was 10 inches of rain. And the Saturday night was 13 inches of rain. Three nights in a row. So it had fine up. Like, wake up that morning after the rain, get out there. The greens would be covered in mud, full water right to the top of the plinth. The outrigging area, which we wouldn't worry about for weeks after we concentrated on, it'd be all logs, debris. To do that three nights in a row, 3 days in a row, all the volunteers that show up, clean it off. I was there for 7 years, so the three floods in that, probably cleaned up five floods in those 7 years. It was devastating.
Can I divert to not many dairies left?
No.
Today?
No.
So all the milk in the Maru area was taken to the Bombardieri Milk Factory?
Yeah. Kangaroo Valley, Kambawara, Jasper's Brush. It was the main, all the other side of the river, Pyrie. Yeah, so the Nowra Dairy Co-op was the major, it was the centre for producing.
All the milk was delivered to Nowra Dairy Co-op?
Yes, yeah, where Truck and Tractor is now, yeah.
But it was located in Bombardieri?
Yes, located in Bombardieri, right beside the rail, where the railway finished.
So what were some of the key factors, just briefly, in your opinion, saw the decline of dairying in your region?
Yeah, I think the small holdings, as they couldn't etch out enough living out of it. Age, where they didn't, families weren't taking it on, like hence myself went greenkeeping. A lot of the other families, the sons didn't carry on.
Impractical, it was unaffordable to continue.
Yeah, yeah. And then your next stage was when bulk milk come into it. So a lot of the farms like ours, they were inaccessible for a big bulk milk tanker. We were allowed then, the milk was accepted then at the dairy co-op. We had to put in a cold room, and so did the others that couldn't go about bulk milk. The only way you could supply milk, put in a cold room, and it was every second day with the can. So we had to take the milk direct to the co-op by truck, by our Land Rover. Other farmers did the same from outlying areas. And eventually then they squeezed and squeezed the ones that were on cans, who they said they would never let down, and it got too much for them, the big powers. And eventually they squeezed those, like Dad and them, the small dairy farmers, got to the stage where they said, well, yeah, we're not going to accept your milk anymore.
Well, what time frame are we talking about?
Dad was still milking surplus milk up to 1976, so I reckon we finished in 1974. Would have been pretty close to getting out of the quota system. And then he still supplied milk with surplus milk, which was a lower price than obviously the quota milk. But it's hard to say. I might be a bit harsh, but they squeezed a lot of farmers. Your milk would get rejected. The ones with cans, you get sediment tests, and that happened quite regularly. And I think they were giving them the message. What they did, that you'd pick the empty can, sorry, when they come back, and there'd be an envelope, was a letter to say your milk was rejected, sediment test, failed sediment test. And they'd have a little sample wad pad in there, and you'd see little specks of yellow butterfat and sometimes some little tiny bits of light dust on it. But I think it got to a regular stage where I think they were trying to give... Yeah, they were phasing out, so you'd only get surplus milk price.
So they were breaking you down.
I think so. Yeah, when you look at it, they wanted it all mechanised bulk milk. They could cut down, I presume. Well, they did. The labour at the co-op would cut down, because when your milk cans come in, you had two blokes you had a, they were metal rollers, so the truck drivers back then, they put them like a metal conveyor belt. They were rollers, so your milk can went on that and followed a chain around. You had two like Roy Woods and Ron Lee. They were the milk graders. So they had a special thing that popped the lids off the milk can. As they'd come past, they'd stick their head in and smell the can, smell the milk, and they were the milk graders. So they would have went for a start. Further down the line, you had the ones that tipped the milk. Yeah, so they would have cut back on labour. You still had your internal workers like Ian Jorgensen you were talking to, his dad and his uncle Bill, his dad Norman. They were retrained and trained. They done all the yogurts and skim milks and things and tanker drivers. They did a bit of tanker driving, that type of thing.
So they were reskilled.
Reskilled.
Think about your dad's car or the land, and you can describe what model and how that was purchased.
Yeah, that was a 1961 Series 2 long wheelbase Land Rover. And they were having mechanical problems with the old 1949 model. It was a long base. And when they were at the pub, which is one afternoon a week, Friday night, Dad would go down and gather with his mates, other dairy farmers and some of the ones from the co-op. You buy your lottery tickets from behind the bar. I think they were 10 shillings or something like that, equal to what you buy now, the $2 jackpot. Him and his cousin, Eric Leslie, Jack Graham, I was only about 3, 4, and they used to announce them at lunch, midday, the lottery winners, name the names, everything, over the radio. And I can remember my mum screaming, grabbed me by the hand, and out the door and off, and dragged me over the gully where they were working to tell them. So that was £2,500, so that's 1966. So that's the price of a Land Rover. So they had to add, I think, another £200 or £300 to that, and were able to buy it brand new.
So they won the lottery.
They won the lottery, yeah.
And where's that Land Rover today?
Yeah, when Mum's place was sold, I had big ideas of restoring it, but never had the money. But Laurie's brother, he's an avid car restorer, and so it went to a mate of his who's restoring it at the moment, which is good.
I wanted to ask you something about, was it your grandmother that died walking home? So when did Minnie Anna pass away?
1920. I'm not quite sure. She was up here visiting a grandmother or for some other medical reason. I know she was a midwife, but she was up here anyway and walking back down the hill to Myrtle Bank in the dark, probably had a hurricane land. She stepped into a hole and hurt herself really bad. They got her into Bury Hospital, which would have been a major thing to transport, probably sulky. But apparently she'd done severe damage to her kidneys, bruised, and she passed away. She only lasted 2-3 days in Bury Hospital. Dad was only 11 when she passed away.
Because it's quite high, the land here.
Oh, look, it's pretty treacherous even walking down there in the daylight. For us to walk down there now, it's that steep.
Your parents married. Where did they meet? Do you know?
Mum, when they were on Browns Mountain, Mum had a, when she came back from Sydney from her cousins.
Okay, so let's slow that down. Can I call her Kitty?
Yes.
Because she's known as Kitty.
Yeah.
So Kitty went to the city.
Yeah, she was, when they moved to Browns Mountain, it was for by her mum and dad, a better education for her, and as a teenager rather than grow up on fully on the farm. She went to live up in Sydney with her old aunties.
Where was that?
In Bondi. And she went to school and grew up with her three cousins.
What was she doing?
The two aunties owned a big cafe restaurant in Bondi. So when she'd come back Obviously, could be school holidays or whenever. She had a job 3 days at the Canberra Lookout in the cafe cooking up there. So she'd ride a horse from Brown's Mountain up through. There was a butter trail there that come up on the point of the Canberra Escarpment. So she'd ride through there. At the time, my dad was working and living with his brother over at Beaumont. And he was working around the side of the hill up towards close to the road, and they started, obviously, I suppose, saying g'day to each other, and then he started courting her. So
what year are we talking about there?
They were married in 1945.
During the war.
Yeah.
So they're on horses?
Yes. Yeah, it was all horseback. Yeah.
What sort of rider was your dad?
Yeah, good.
What sort of horses?
Stock horses, yeah. Yeah, the ones from the farm here. They were probably locally bred back in those days. There was horses were everywhere, yeah. Mum, only through talking to her in the nursing home and that, her horse pony was called Pixie, the one she'd ride to the lookout. There was a black mare called Mabel, and then there was a piebald horse that Dad had to the end was called Dell. During the Second World War, they formed a militia, the home, what the English would call a home guard. They were probably ex-World War One, but the head of it was Jim Sturgis from up in Sassafras.
Can I just slow that down a minute? So the militia, it was a locally formed group of men?
Yeah. Ones that were too old to go away. Some of the ones, my dad, he was recalled for essential services after he trained and kitted out. So they trained one afternoon a week along where Campbell Sail Yards are now, apparently. That was the shooting range. So they...
What were they training for? What was the point of the
militia?
Well,
they thought if a Japanese landed at Jervis Bay, and I don't know what they were going to do, but they put a few strategic plans in place, and one of them was they had the Canberra Mountain and the tourist road. It was all dynamited, the charges were set, ready to dynamite the mountain if the word come through that the Japanese had landed in Jervis Bay. They also needed, they said if that happened, they wanted it somewhere to get off the mountain where they could head for Kangaroo Valley and Budjong in a hurry. So they came up to the mountain, and my mum's older brother, he took them around and showed them to the point overlooking Budjong. And he said, this is where you can get off. And the story from Uncle Dud was that Jim Sturgis said, no way, you can't, man nor horse could never get down there. And Uncle Dud says, well, I'll have you know, my sister rides down there and rides down there bareback.
So she must have been quite a capable person, Kitty.
Yeah.
What do you remember about Kitty as a young man?
Yeah, she was a hard worker beside Dad on the farm. When you look back now, doting mum, just devoted her time, life to what she did with Dad and us kids, and never wanted for anything. She was a brilliant cook.
Thank you, Richard. To see photos relating to this podcast, follow me on Instagram, Therese Makes History, or go to my website, theresesweeney.com.au. Give me 48 hours. Thank you. If you heard ticking whilst listening to today's podcast, it's just Richard's metal heart valves. He calls them his chaff cutters. Tune in Tuesday fortnight for episode 4, Le Mans Lane, or as they say, Lemon's Lane. Thanks for joining me. Catch you then.